Hi, I'm Carmen Wong Ulrich, and you're listening to the Marketplace Money Podcast for the weekend of December 13th, 2013. So this show is about you and the choices that you make every day and how to not only get more money out of those choices, but more value. So this week in How We Live Money, how to save when you're your own boss. And for those of you in between or changing jobs, how to get your hard-earned savings out of limbo. Also, some big ticket items are at even bigger discounts this time of year. How to get the best deal on your wheels. But first, let's start with a listener.
Carmen.
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 Carmen. Carmen, what's going on?
I'm here for you. Mark lives in Great Falls, Montana. He's 66. He's retired, and he's ready to make a big change in his life. Welcome, Mark, to the show.
Well, thank you.
So, Mark, talk to me a little bit about what's going on in terms of yourself personally that's affecting the finances, or going to, possibly.
Well, basically, I was widowed 3 years ago, and I've decided that it is time to start dating again. And mostly, I'm wondering what kind of financial considerations I should keep in mind if I meet another wonderful woman and we decide to get married.
Ah, this is a very interesting question. And by the way, I love your love for love at the age of 66. You're starting out this new phase. And I have to ask you, though, Mark, you know, you mentioned that in your relationship, you were married for 40 years.
Very close, yeah.
Who managed the money?
Actually, my wife did.
How was she good at it?
Oh, she was very good at it. Basically, the short story is, early on in our marriage, on a payday, I was doing the checkbook, she was doing out shopping groceries. And when she got home, both of us were pulling our hair out. So we thought, let's switch this and see what happens. Well, within 6 months, we had money in the bank and food in the pantry.
Good man, Mark. But you are a good man to hand things over. Because in a relationship, usually one person's better at it than the other.
Oh, and she was very good at it. And I'm learning.
What did she do that was really good at it that you're finding that you're adapting?
She was a saver more than I am, and I've had to learn to rein in my expenses. You know, I always thought, well, there's money, I can afford that. Well, that's not the case anymore. My income now is fixed. I have all the pensions I have coming to me, and I don't know if I will be so moved to go back to work.
In terms of meeting other women and dating, you've been dating already.
Well, I've met a couple of very nice women, yeah.
And do you talk about money at all?
One lady was upset when I insisted on paying for dinner because she wanted to pay Dutch.
Oh, hasn't dating changed from when you were you dated 40 years ago?
A lot of women today are feeling more independent.
So most of the women that you're meeting are probably working and earning their own income?
Or have, mm-hmm. or are financially independent in a manner that I am.
And so what do you see as possibly coming down the line? Is this about, okay, how do I talk about money and how do we arrange our money should we come together?
That's kind of what I'm looking for.
Well, one of the things to consider for sure is the fact that when you're dating later in life, the odds are that you're going to encounter and date and possibly be with somebody for the long term who makes and earns their own money. So it's as if you're combining households and very independent households, especially if you're retirement age. So then it's about, okay, when do you start talking about money? And then if and when you do get married again or team up and partner up together, living under the same roof, how do you manage your money in this new environment of independence?
Is it who's going to pay for the groceries? Who's going to pay for the utilities? Or is it we may create a common checking account and do we use that for household expenses and living expenses?
Well, that's one of the things that because you'll both be bringing in your own money for a lot of couples, whether it's later in life or you're just getting married and you're young, to consider the fact that you both will probably earn money and you want some sense of autonomy, especially if you're older. You're just very used to managing and having your own money. So to respect that, it's really good idea what you just mentioned, which is to have an account of for shared expenses. So having that checking account that I call your household account, where you basically put together and pool, okay, how much is our living every month going to cost us? And you contribute to that account. And then you can also have a household savings account. And this account would be for, let's say, if you want to take a vacation every year.
If she happens to have kids and grandkids, I wouldn't want them to feel like I'm taking any finances away from them. I would want them to understand that what their mother, grandmother has is theirs.
To your point about the extended family, and there is this idea of, okay, well, how much do I contribute or how much is going to go towards this new spouse's family? But someone, in terms of your future spouse, may actually come at you with a prenup.
And I don't have any trouble with that.
Great. You're a catch, Mark. But here's the thing, Mark. You bring up a lot of great points. You're dating. It's good first to not, you don't necessarily have to talk about credit scores and debt and income and all that stuff at the forefront before you have necessarily a committed relationship. But it's good to kind of look at these hints, like you mentioned. Do they have trouble if we split the bill or not? Or do they mm-hmm. have trouble with me paying? All these things give little hints to you.
Yeah.
But then once you start getting a little serious, to really talk about your finances in a very friendly kind of way. This is how things are these days. And to not be afraid to do that. You think you can do that?
I'm going to have to give it a whirl.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Mark, and keep us posted.
Okay. It's been fun, Carmen.
Oh, it's been fun for us, too. Send us your questions and your stories. Go to MarketplaceMoney.org and click on the Ask Carmen link. You can also record a question there. Click on the button below and be sure to tell us your name and location so we can have you on soon. So it's good to hear that folks like Mark are starting these new, exciting chapters in life. But speaking of starting afresh, car dealers are reporting a 40% jump in sales this Black Friday weekend from last year. And November car sales, the best in 6 years. Even more interesting, the data from Edmunds.com says now that we are buying and leasing the new cars versus the used and certified pre-owned. And as you know, that's a really big shift from the popularity of used cars over new during the height of the recession. So why new and why now? Here to talk about it is Ron Montoya, the consumer advice editor for Edmunds.com. Welcome, Ron.
Thanks for having me on.
So, Ron, you guys did a new analysis at Edmunds, and you found that there's a reversal of a big trend in car buying because folks like me, when the recession came, we all said, buy used, and even better, buy CPO, certified pre-owned cars with the backing of the manufacturer. And that was pretty much where a lot of people were going. But what's changed?
Well, what's changed is that people are buying more new cars. When you buy a new car, you end up trading in your used one, so that creates an extra used car in the fleet and more cars are available. So now that there's more used cars, the prices are starting to drop, so you can get much better deals on used cars nowadays.
This is the first time that the numbers are like this in a long time, right?
Yeah, this is the lowest levels we've seen in about 4 years.
Well, but Ron, besides the supply and demand, which is, of course, basic economics, what else do you feel may be, making this change happen? Is it that new cars are becoming great deals? Is it about financing? What else is going on?
New cars, you can get much better finance rates on them. And in addition to that, there's also better deals on leasing, and it's become much more popular to lease nowadays. People are less hesitant to sort of lease a car for a couple of years and get into a new one because the monthly payments are more attractive and the interest rates are much better. So more cars that are out there, and with regards to a lease, it will create a used car in a couple of years once they turn that in.
2 years ago, on New Year's Eve, I purchased a new car because I always told people to buy used. But in my case, the compact, tiny thing that I bought, by waiting till the last day of the year and using the internet to get them to bid against each other, plus super, super, super low financing, I was able to get that brand new car for less or the same price as a used one.
Yeah, that's something that started to happen when used car prices were going up, is that we found that in a number of situations, it would be a better deal to get a new car than it was to get a used car, because the prices just were so inflated on these used cars. And some of the incentives on new cars, you know, you could get like a couple thousand off the sticker price. They'd be willing to discount it on top of that. And it ended up being a better deal to get a new car. So that's starting to turn around a little bit, but you can potentially find a couple of situations like that.
Now, Ron, after our housing expenses, our transportation is usually the next biggest part of our budget pie and our household budget. So if folks are looking this time of year, like I did, to get the best price on a new car, what are some tips you can give them, particularly for right now?
Well, at this time, there's a lot of models that are starting to change over. So when you're looking at cars, consider a 2013 model now that the 2014s are starting to come out. You may find better discounts on those. It's that same model. You're going to find more price flexibility on that. And I would recommend you contact the internet salesperson of a dealership. We find that they're more straightforward with price. And call a number of dealers. Let them know that you're sort of shopping around. And that's the best way to get a price quote.
That's what I did. And Ron, I got the best price on the car. It was so good that I had the guy who sold me the car say to me, "Darn it, people like you. Thank goodness we have people that are willing to pay above sticker."
Well, you know, you're always going to have someone that's going to make you think that that you took their lunch from them. But, you know, ultimately, the dealer is always going to make money on their side of the deal.
Ron Montoya is the consumer advice editor for Edmunds.com. Ron, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And if you're planning on buying a new or used car in 2014, tweet us at LiveMoney or head over and write to us at MarketplaceMoney.org. Next, getting paid piecemeal does not mean giving up on your retirement.
I've had my own business 11 years, and it's been a great way for me to save consistently, even though I don't know exactly what I'm earning, but I've been able to put that money away. And then twice a year, I just really fund my SEP IRA, and it's been a great way for me to build my retirement savings that way.
Retirement planning when you work for yourself or while you're job hunting. SEPs, solo Ks, IRAs. We've got the keys to saving right. Coming up on Marketplace Money from APM. So, we're ending the year on a happy note, a note of cheer. When it comes to job numbers, the unemployment rate hit a 5-year low in November. However, millions of Americans are still out of work. And we're becoming a freelance nation. We're working part-time or working for ourselves more now than ever. But here's the question. How do you save for retirement when you don't have a regular income or when you're hopping from employer to employer? Galia Gishon joins me today. She's a financial educator and founder of DownToEarthFinance.com. She works often with freelancers and part-timers. Welcome, Galia.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
So, Galia, one of the specialties that you have is working with independent contractors, freelancers, as we call them. And there's some
Absolutely.
Really scary stats about the financial habits of folks who work for themselves. So, for example, TD Ameritrade found in a survey that nearly 70% of those who are self-employed are not saving for retirement on a regular basis. This is what they're saying. Galia, what is really the issue here as to the barrier to why can't freelancers and independent contractors save money like someone who is salaried or gets paid regularly?
So I would say probably the number one barrier is that they have an unsteady flow of income or unsteady paycheck. So they don't get income regularly. So totally, they might actually get the same amount of money as they were if they were working corporate or if they were working in a full-time job. But because they get paid irregularly, they just get cash, they put it in their checking account, and they don't do anything with it. And they don't necessarily build the good habits of just paying themselves first, putting them on a budget, really just spreading out the money over the 52 weeks or the 12 months.
Now, you know, one of the things that sends us into this freelance nation, actually, is, you know, the unemployment numbers in the economy. And a lot of folks, a lot of corporations are not hiring full-timers so much as contractors. So a lot of people who are unemployed are finding themselves working for themselves or wanting to. And we've got CJ on the phone from Richland, Washington. CJ's 27. She's an engineer. Go, girl. And you did lose your job, CJ, a couple months ago, and you're on unemployment insurance, but you have a question about your savings.
Yeah, that's right. I have about $45,000 in a 401k account. That's with my previous employer. You know, so now that I am not employed with them anymore, I have some limitations on what I can do with it. And, you know, from what I've read, what kind of the general advice is that the safest place to put the money is in the funds in a 401k that have the lowest fees. Is that really the best strategy?
So, CJ, let me ask you, when you say safer, what does that mean to you? What does safe look like to you?
Well, at the moment, I'm, you know, financially unstable. I don't know when I'm going to get a job again. I need to be able to have that money. You know, I want it someplace where it's not going to drop because of a fund that lost a lot, you know, in a period of time. Also want it to be accessible to me, you know.
Oh, so it's there if you were to need it. So, Galia, the idea of safe and versus fees, you know, what's the relationship there?
Well, I think that there's a few ways to look at this money. This is your retirement money. So I would just start by saying, if you can, CJ, try not to touch it. Because you did already save this for your long-term and your retirement, and most people don't have enough money saved for retirement or won't have enough. So I'd say let this be your last resort. But at the same time, thinking about the fees that you're paying and keeping it safe are such important things to think about. Just on a long-term basis, say, if I can try not to touch it, let me not.
Yeah, that's absolutely my plan. You know, worst-case scenario, I need to deal
right,
with.
Right. But I love that you want to roll it over and take more control of it, because I agree with you that most 401ks tend to have higher fees. So you should definitely roll it over. My favorite places are no-load mutual fund companies like Fidelity or Vanguard. And so you can at least on a first-step basis roll it over to just a rollover IRA. So it'll still be in the retirement status, but you've got it closer to you at least. And then second of all, if you want to keep it safe or maybe just on a short-term basis, you don't necessarily have to invest it in the stock market. You could just leave it in a money market, even though for the long term, that would be a terrible choice. But at least initially, if you really are thinking, gosh, I need the money, I want to preserve principal, let me at least not keep it invested, or just at least a portion. Maybe you keep a few thousand.
That's an interesting point that you're making, that it's if your employment status can sometimes influence your long-term retirement planning. Galia, is that something that you regularly, you know, recommend to folks, particularly the long-term unemployed?
Absolutely. And I think a lot of people make decisions based on fear. They're just nervous that they're not going to get a job or they're not going to get a work, so they don't save the money, they don't invest it. And then what I see is they've come to me and they've said, oh, I haven't done anything in 2 years. So they've missed out on savings. They've also missed out on market opportunities. But it's really the fear of what's going on that prohibits us from really doing something with our money.
Well, CJ, do you think, you know, weighing the risk of losing out on some gains on your long-term investment versus needing the money in case you don't find something, where do you place those odds? What do you think is more likely to happen?
You know, I do have several thousand dollars in personal savings in a bank account. For the short term, I'm okay. You know, I don't need to touch my 401k. You know, I'm just kind of looking at the long-term game. There's only one person in my immediate family who's employed.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, we've been struggling with that. And, of course, it's my dad. My parents have been, you know, I can come live with them and it's all fine. It'll be okay. And so I do have, I guess, kind of a stable outlook in that regard. They don't really plan on having to touch the money. But one thing I've been concerned about is you talked about rolling it into an IRA, even though, like I said, I believe this, that those have fewer protections in terms of, you know, possible bankruptcy and stuff. Is that correct?
Well, I believe that if it's whether it's in the 401k or the rollover IRA, it would be the same because essentially it's the same sort of tax status, if you will. So it shouldn't be any different. It's just really where the money is being managed.
Yeah, and isn't that true, Galia, that whatever the form of the IRA, whether it's a Roth, whether it's a traditional, whether it's a rollover, that they all offer the same protection under bankruptcy?
That's correct. That is correct.
So yeah, I wouldn't worry, CJ, I wouldn't worry so much about transforming them, because I think a lot of folks get worried when they turn one thing into something else. Essentially, what Galia is saying is that by rolling something over, you are keeping its status as tax-free growth, tax-free savings, protection from bankruptcy. But what about Galia? What about CJ when she gets another job? We hear from a lot of folks who carry multiple 401ks or multiple retirement accounts from employers. And then they're like, well, I've got like three now. What do I do?
Right. I see this. I had a client come to me with five different old 401ks and IRAs. And of course, that's a headache. So there's really two ways you want to look at it. First of all, I still think even if you aren't employed yet, you should still roll it over to an independent firm, because it brings the money one step closer into your control. You can now control the fees. You can also control the investment choices, because if you, for example, went to Vanguard, you can choose, you know, of the 100 plus mutual funds that Vanguard offers. So that's number one. I think definitely bringing it to someplace closer to you is a much, much smarter financial move. Secondly, if you get a new job, you can always roll over an old 401k to your new job. But I think just rolling over old 401ks to an independent financial place is a much better longer-term financial move, because it lets you control the money better in terms of fees and investment choices.
And fees are a big concern for you, right, CJ? What do you know what your fees are currently?
Yeah, I calculated out, and I diversified a little bit. So the range is about 0.2% to one fund that's actually all the way up at 1%, but it averages at about 0.5%. As far as I've read, that's not like too bad in terms of what the fees are.
Yeah, I was going to say, how does it make you feel if I tell you that the average is closer to 1.3%?
I was going to say, that's what
I heard. I was actually surprised that once they actually calculated out, I was surprised that it was as low as it was.
Higher. So would she get savings? Galia, would she have savings? Absolutely.
Okay. So at Vanguard, I think their average expense ratio, which is the fees you're talking about, is about 0.2725. That's the average. So you can do like a large S&P 500 index or a total stock market index, which is, you know, 0.05 practically if you have a large enough investment in it. So I think Vanguard, if you're concerned about fees, is your best bet from a fee standpoint. But really, most large mutual fund companies offer index funds anyhow. Fidelity, Schwab, you know, most of the large companies do regardless. So you really, as long as you stick to index funds, it's a great way to keep your fees low.
Yeah, and I do have some of those currently. In my current 401k, I have some funds that are, you know, closely keyed to index funds. And so they have pretty low fees too. There's, I think the lowest is 0.18%. So, that's something I was thinking, because one of the options they offered me was being able to take this, my current, you know, distribution, and I get one opportunity to swap that around if I want to.
Right. And again, that's another reason why I think you want to roll it over to a place of your choice, because then you can make those changes whenever you want. Like, why be limited to the restrictions that this company is placing on you when you're not even working there anymore?
And that's it. And they have each company's 401k is very, very different, because they have their certain deals with the 401k administrator as to what they're going to offer you. But CJ, so what do you think? I just want to applaud you first, can I say, for being 27 years old and having almost $50,000 socked away for retirement.
Absolutely,
bravo.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it helps having the engineering degree. I've had a pretty decent salary for a couple of years there.
I would certainly hope you wouldn't be waiting too long for another job. And to your point about, you know, saving for retirement, but you only have a couple thousand saved in cash, I would encourage you, and Galia, tell me if you agree or disagree, but I would encourage you to save a bit more cash the next time around.
Actually, let's see, total it's around 13,000. So it's enough to keep me afloat for four or five months.
There you go. I thought you were talking like $2,000. You're
talking.
No,
right.
You've
got
right.
I feel like I've been pretty smart with my savings.
I would say so. And I really don't see you touching this 401k. So as a result, definitely don't leave it in cash. Make sure you invest it and take advantage of the diversification in the markets for the longer term.
CJ, what do you think? So you might go over and roll it over to save that 0.8%, maybe 0.1 to 0.8%. But those savings compound, and you're young. So you've got a lot of years there for the fees to eat away at what you've got. And then choice is a factor.
That's why I've been concerned about it.
Yeah. And choice is a factor, too. But I think CJ, you're ahead of the game.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for joining us, CJ.
All right. Thank you both.
CJ is going to be our super saver. Our super saver of the week is CJ from Richland, Washington. Galia, stay with us. We're going to return to answer more questions after this break. Now, Galia, we're going to go to an email. It's from Lynn from Los Angeles, who has a question about freelance retirement accounts. She has a SEP, S-E-P, IRA, and wants to know if she should open a solo 401k. How do you look at retirement as a contract employee? Because, Galia, we just talked with CJ about employer benefit IRAs. Now, Lynn from L.A. is saying, okay, I work for myself. Got a SEP. Do I also need something else? And what are my options?
First of all, I'm just so excited that Lynn is saving for retirement because I work with so many freelancers who don't pay themselves or save for retirement. So I'm excited that she's doing that. And I would also say, just on a positive note, that a benefit of being a freelancer is you can actually contribute much more to retirement plans. Because if you just work for a company and have a 401k, you're pretty much maxed out at $17,500 a year. Whereas if you have a SEP IRA or if you're a high earner and want to do an individual or solo 401k, which I'll explain in a minute, you can actually put a lot more money away. So this new solo 401k, it's a fairly new retirement plan, and it's for people who only work for themselves. So if you have full-time employees working with you, you cannot do it. And it's really geared towards high-income earners. So really what you can do is you can put up to 25% of your AGI, your adjusted gross income, and then it's capped at $51,000 a year. And if you do a solo 401k, you can add another $17,500 a year to that $51,000. So that means on a pre-tax basis, you can contribute almost $70,000 a year. So that's a lot of money to put away in retirement on an annual basis.
And Galia, explain the difference between the SEP, the Simplified Employee Pension, and those limits versus the solo 401k.
So the SEP is really the first part of the solo 401k in that you can either do it if you work for yourself or if you do have people who work for you or with you full time. So Lynn happens to be a freelancer, but if you're listening and you're perhaps a small business owner or freelancer, and you've got a full-time person working with you. So it's really geared towards those work for themselves or have a very, very small business. And so the SEP lets you contribute up to 25% of your adjusted gross income, and then that's capped at $51,000 a year. So that means if you're earning $204,000 adjusted gross income, you can contribute $51,000. To a SEP retirement plan or a SEP IRA.
And then the solo 401k lets you save another $17,500. So that's definitely a high earner thing. So Lynn should look at, you know, what she is earning. But to that point, as we know, that's a nice little tax deduction as well.
It is. It is. So, for example, say she earns $100,000, she would only be able to contribute $25,000 to a SEP IRA. Because
and
it's
deduct
25%.
That.
And deduct that, exactly. Now, say she had a solo 401k, she could add another $17,500 to it. The question is, does she have the cash flow?
Exactly.
So that's why it's really geared towards people. Right. So it really depends on what you're earning. And you can always do the SEP IRA 1 year, the solo 401k the next year. It's not like you're married or permanently to the plan by any means.
But what, and also having the discipline to do it, because this is one of those things as a contract employee, as a freelancer, and for the folks of you who are listening who have full-time jobs, this may be your future. So listen in, because this is where most business is headed. We have to become our own human resource managers and save for ourselves and for our retirement. So we really need to have a system in place, just as freelancers need to pay quarterly taxes, prepay your own taxes. You should also be prepaying yourself or paying yourself in terms of retirement savings.
And so can I just give a quick tip on how to put that money away? So
yes.
So ideally, if you open it at a mutual fund company like a Fidelity or Schwab, they might let you link it to your checking account. But part of it is that you don't know how much to put in because it's really based on what you earn for the year. So you don't know how much you're going to earn. So what I do, since I'm a freelancer, I work for myself, is that every time I get paid, I have a savings account, an online savings account, and I take 10% or 5% or whatever I think I can afford and put that just into my online savings account. And so the money is put away. It's not necessarily earning a lot, but at least I can't touch it. It's out of sight, out of mind. And then quarterly or twice a year when I know better what my income was, then I add it to my SEP IRA.
And in worst-case scenario, in worst-case scenario, it's kind of like a little emergency fund.
Exactly. But it's been a great way. I've had my own business 11 years, and it's been a great way for me to save consistently, even though I don't know exactly what I'm earning, but I've been able to put that money away. And then twice a year, I just really fund my SEP IRA. And it's been a great way for me to build my retirement savings that way.
Excellent strategy and habits to have. Galia Gishon is the founder of Down to Earth Finance. And if you have a question, we would love to hear from you because it sounds like you guys are really on point. Go to Ask Carmen over at MarketplaceMoney.org. Click on that button, leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or tweet at Live Money. Next, a lesson on plastic taught by mom and dad.
I can remember, you know, the arguments my parents would have would be about credit card bills. And as a result, I don't buy anything on a credit card. I never wanted to have that feeling, that sinking sort of like that I owed somebody something. It's a horrible feeling.
Plus, need to make some extra money this month? A conversation about the gig economy. Those stories are coming up on Marketplace Money from APM. Money stories from when we were kids and how our parents handled the family finances really shapes what we do now with our own money. So here's where we like to turn the mic over. Today, an indie rocker shares her memories.
I'm Eleanor Friedberger. I'm 37 years old and I live in New York. My parents split up when I was about 8 or 9 years old. They approach money pretty differently, the two of them. And I think that probably was part of the reason why they stopped getting along. But I can remember, you know, the arguments my parents would have would be about, like, credit card bills. And as a result, I don't buy anything on a credit card. I never wanted to have that feeling, that sinking sort of, like, that I owed somebody something. It's a horrible feeling. My dad, and he would be the first to admit, you know, he's very stingy. Once he had his own household, the heat was at the absolute minimum. We were freezing all the time. My mother's parents would come over to our house and bring, like, you know, 3 sweaters. He was a cheap guy, you know. I think some of my friends might describe me that way, too. I mean, I'd like to say frugal, but very sensible when it comes to money. But, you know, I like to splurge once in a while, too, and I probably get that from my mother. I think my mother was a little bit more spoiled. I don't go to Barney's and buy a $500 dress. I'll go to a vintage store and buy a $100 dress or an $80 dress. I don't need it because I have 100 other dresses, you know, and then I'll think, oh, I'm just like my mother. You have to be comfortable with not knowing when you're going to get paid next, you know. After December 20th, I don't know what I'm doing. It's very hard to plan your life in any sort of reasonable way when you don't have steady income, and I do not have steady income. So I've had great years, and I've had bad years, and I've had okay years, and I've had mostly years that I just get by, which is good enough, considering I get to do something pretty great.
So what money lessons were handed down to you? Good or bad, tweet them to us at Live Money. And idle's the engine. You know, sometimes like Eleanor, we shake things up. When we grow up, we create a new way of living, but all in response to the bad habits of those around us. And going against the grain, it can be exactly what we need to move forward. So with that in mind, this little blog caught our eye. 7 Ways to Eat Good on a Hood Budget. It's authored by the musician Kanum Imobu, better known as Stick, from the hip-hop group Dead Prez.
They say you are what you eat, so I strive to eat healthy. My goal in life is not to be rich or wealthy, cause true wealth comes from good health and wise ways. We got to start taking better care of ourselves, be healthy, y'all.
We invited Stick and his wife, Afia, she's a nutritionist, here to talk about how their family breaks bread without breaking the bank. Stick, Afia, welcome to Marketplace Money.
Salute, salute.
Hey.
Stick, you wrote a blog post, 7 Ways to Eat Good on a Hood Budget. And there's a lot of misconceptions about the community and the ability on a tight budget to get real good, fresh food.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. A lot of people, you know, feel that it's tougher, it's more expensive because our concept of what health food is. And we think it's, you know, all the packaged foods and the whole foods aisle. But really, the most dense nutrient-wise foods are the cheapest. It's the produce aisle. So, you know, lettuce, apples, carrots, things of that nature is the cheapest thing in the whole supermarket. So that's the first thing about health food being less expensive is what is health food.
So when you were growing up, how was that different when you were a kid as to how you're raising your kids now?
Right on. Well, when I grew up, you know, soul food was the thing. We ate fish fries and the soul food fixings. That's how I grew up. And until I read Malcolm X's autobiography, I never thought about food as it relates to our health. And, you know, Malcolm would talk about the pork, its relationship to hypertension and high blood pressure. And I started thinking about my family, my uncles, cousins, and all of the different health issues. And it made me say, wow, I didn't know. And at that point, you know, I got radicalized. Our son, he's 12 now. He grew up vegan. He was born vegan, and he's jumping off the walls and turning back flips. So he's all right.
As a boy should.
I actually was very sick as a kid, and I became a vegetarian at 15 due to health issues. You know, I grew up, my mother, she was a single mother. She worked 3 jobs, so we were kind of on our own. So it was like fast food, soda, Twinkies, you know, that was my main food. And then just being sick all the time, I finally found a doctor who said it could be the foods that I was eating. And that is really what started my journey on this health path.
So how much have you saved financially right now in terms of the way you shop and also down the road?
We have a dedicated account for, you know, like grocery shopping and monthly things like that. My wife is the financial mastermind.
Aha. All right, Afia.
So that's how I do it. I just let her do it. And one of the things that you do is you make food for the week. You know, you make a big pot of pasta or a big pot of rice, you know, beans in bulk.
And Afia, you know, I'm a busy single mom and there's a lot to do. So how can I best manage myself to make sure that I'm eating right when I'm running around?
I'm a mom too. So I have to think ahead, make big meals. I'll make like a big pot of soup. That will be my lunch, our dinner, our son's lunch. And sometimes it's about priorities. Like if I want to watch Scandal, you know what I'm saying? Can I do that and be making some food at the same time?
She ain't lying.
That's what I'm going to do so I can catch up on Scandal is I'm going to cook while I have it on next to me. Now, when it comes to money and it comes to spending and your health, it's really about what you choose to spend your money on.
That's right. You know, I really value feeling good. I really value having energy. So when I have to make a choice between, you know, this or that, I'm always going to choose the organic source of nutrients, you know, because that's going to make everything else I want to do possible.
And I just want to say something here. If you drink alcohol, if you smoke cigarettes, if you have more than basic cable, if your kids have video games, if you're on name brand stuff, you know, if you can afford to do these things, then you can afford to eat healthier. So once again, it goes back to priorities.
All right, so we actually save money in the long run by taking care of our health. Someone listening right now is saying, okay, I'm inspired. I'm ready to go to the grocery store and make the right choices, but they also have to be the right choices for my wallet. So talk me through it a bit and tell them where should they go and how should they shop.
Farmers market. That is one of the most inexpensive places to purchase food because it's not marked up like a regular grocery store would be. And then those foods are usually seasonal. So if you buy what's in season, that's usually cheaper as well. So if you try to buy a watermelon now, it's going to be more expensive than it would be in the summertime. And then once again, buying in bulk, not so much packaged pre-made foods. And not that you can't have that. That should just not be the main thing in your basket.
Also, co-ops, you know, a lot of times you can volunteer to get savings.
And one of the cheapest ways to get food is to grow it yourself. It costs about $1 for a whole pack of seeds, and you only need a few seeds to get a whole bunch of produce. And, you know, when I was growing up, we just had a patio. I lived in apartments, but my mother would have these big tubs, and she would grow green peppers. She would grow tomatoes. You can grow a lot of things just right on your patio, and that's cheaper, and it's organic.
Stick and Afia Mubu, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having us.
Be healthy, y'all.
You can find a link to Stick's blog, 7 Ways to Eat Good on a Hood Budget, at marketplacemoney.org. You know, we're definitely much more of a freelance economy now more than ever. And as we talked about earlier with Galia Gishon, this way of working really requires us to manage our own retirement savings. But there's also another money-earning economy. It's a lot more piecemeal. Even though there's much, much money to be made here, Washington is calling it the gig economy. Now, these are folks who earn money hour by hour, gig by gig. And there are several now big online resources for finding these gigs or, like I prefer, finding someone to pay to do what you're not able to do. So for an inside look, we called TaskRabbit COO Stacy Brown Philpott. Thanks for being here, Stacy.
Thank you for having me.
So Stacy, explain to most folks, I mean, I've been following the site for a long time because it really changes how some folks can make money hourly. Can you explain how it all works?
Yeah, so TaskRabbit is a website and mobile app where people and businesses can go to outsource jobs to people right in their neighborhood. So if you need groceries delivered, or your house cleaned, a handyman to help you put together furniture, you just log into TaskRabbit, post what you need to get done, and background checked TaskRabbits in your neighborhood will begin bidding on the job. All of our TaskRabbits go through a vetting process that includes an extensive background check, and they have the option to submit a video as well.
Oh, so that's very important about the background checks. You want to make sure you know who you're hiring. But on the earning side, the folks who use TaskRabbit to earn money, when you say bidding for the jobs, so basically are they all kind of low bidding each other?
No, the amount of money a TaskRabbit makes actually depends on what the task poster is willing to pay. They set the price, the TaskRabbit bids, and then they're selected based on who they feel is most qualified. Our most active TaskRabbits make about 3 or 4 tasks a day and can make up to $6,000 a month.
That's like real earning money.
Yeah, it is.
What percentage or what fraction of task rabbits, which I feel funny calling them that, but they are rabbits, really use this as full-time income?
About 10%.
That's quite a bit. Do you see that growing? Is that a number that stayed stable or does it fluctuate a bit?
That number is definitely growing, especially as we launch into new markets.
And what does it look like for someone who says, you know what, I want to earn extra money?
Our most popular tasks are handyman and moving help, like assembling IKEA furniture, which you like, fixing things around the house, gardening. We also have a lot of cleaning tasks, both for homes and businesses. And finally, seasonal help. Whenever there's a holiday, we see a large influx of tasks. And you can imagine that with Christmas coming up, we're going to see a lot of activity in that area for the rest of the year.
So it does tend to be seasonal. Do you feel like that we are heading into, because I do feel like we're getting into this freelance economy where there's fewer full-time with benefits folks getting hired. you know, is this really just kind of capturing a trend, creating opportunity? And what are some of the snags along the way?
We're creating opportunities for people to work the way they want to work. They have flexibility, they have choice, they have the option to choose the number of hours they want to work and the types of things that they want to work on.
I'm wondering if, in terms of what you can make, what, and always looking at that earner, because I'm sure there's definitely lots of value to hiring someone. I know I would love to, be just because it's people at your fingertips who have been pre-sorted. Can you give me a range of, you know, the earnings? You mentioned, you know, up to $6,000 a month, but the hourly wages, where do they fall? Because there's a lot of talk about, you know, the minimum wage and hourly wages. What is the range?
We don't share that number publicly, but it really does depend on their level of activity. So we can see when a TaskRabbit who's doing 3 to 4 tasks a day, they cash out at up to $6,000 a month. When we look at TaskRabbits who do fewer tasks, it really does depend on their activity and, quite frankly, their skill level. Various tasks dictate the skill level. So a person who's a handyman will probably make more than a person who's a delivery TaskRabbit.
And since you're working with both sides of the equation here, you have the folks that are doing the work and the folks that need the work done. Where do you see the demand? Is it equally weighed that you have the same amount and the same demand on both sides, or is it skewed a bit?
We're constantly looking at where is demand and where is supply, and we look at it at the geography level too, at the local market level. And so we track metrics like fulfillment, and if we see that there's a great amount of demand, for example, the end of the month, you can imagine that moving activity picks up. We make sure we have enough supply. So we really look at each market in a segmented way and do a what I call a dance of balancing the marketplace to fulfill every task that gets posted.
So with the holidays coming, how much do I want to bet that you have TaskRabbits that list that they wrap Christmas presents or holiday presents?
Yes, it is. We do indeed.
Thank you so much, Stacey Brown. Philpott is the COO of TaskRabbit.com.
Thank you.
Oh, it is a chilly time of year for most of us, so why not head down to a more balmy Florida for a money question from the Magic Kingdom?
Hi, Carmen. My name is Zach. I am 32 years old, and I live in Orlando, Florida. I am an actor, singer down here. I do have a full-time job performing at Disney World, and I have two questions for you about retirement investing. I am already maxing out my Roth IRA every year, and I want to invest more in my retirement. And I'm trying to decide if I should contribute to a 401k that doesn't have a company match, or if I should just open a brokerage account and choose some total market index funds to contribute to. I'm not sure about the cost of the plans in the 401k, but I've looked at the funds, and there just are not very many options that I like. There's nothing that's total market. So any advice you could give me on that would be great. I love your show. Hope to hear from you.
Oh, Zach, thank you so much. How smart of you to think about what your 401k options are, because a lot of folks don't really pay attention to that. And it's really good to note that you have limited choices, because it can absolutely affect what kind of return you're getting there. Now, here's the thing. As you don't have a company match, there's not necessarily a huge push for you to keep putting money just in the 401k. It's great that you're maxing out the Roth IRA, but you can't have another IRA. If you're maxing out the Roth, you've maxed out your options in terms of a traditional IRA or a Roth. So the limits apply to all IRAs that you have. There should be an option within your Roth for a total market index fund. If not, and you're looking to put more money away for retirement, you're going to have to get out of tax-friendly products and someplace else. So a discount brokerage firm with a lot of information can help you invest on your own in a total market index fund with very, very low costs. So head to Fidelity or Vanguard. Those are the favorites in this industry. They have low fees, but also they have a lot of information for you so you can make the right choices and invest the right right way. Zach, thank you so much for your question, and good luck. Hope to see you at Disney World next year. And if you have a question that you'd like answered on air, head over to marketplacemoney.org. There's a little button there that says Ask Carmen, and right below, record your voicemail. I'd love to hear from you.
Please leave a message after the tone.
That's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, the art of the ask and give. How to donate your dollars the right way. Marketplace Money is produced by Nancy Fargali, Raghu Manavalan, Candice Manriquez, Lindsay Foster Thomas. Jeff Peters is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Carmen Wong Ulrich. Remember, always check with your financial pro before you make any big money decisions. Thanks for listening, and let's talk soon.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM.